Okay, we were at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, and then the year after I was Roger Adams' postdoc, I was appointed to the teaching staff, I guess, as an instructor. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes.
I was appointed an instructor for a year or two. And I taught the elementary organic course for pre-meds and home ec students.
Mm-hmm.
And got started with a few senior research students. I guess I very soon also taught qual organic. I'm not sure whether I taught it the first year or not.
Mm-hmm.
My main recollection is that my main responsibility was teaching the elementary organic course for pre-med and home ec students.
Mm-hmm. Was there a qual organic book by Fusan at that time?
Fusan and
Schreiner? Schreiner was already there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I knew those.
Yeah, they were both there. And Fusan and Connor had written the book that we were using for our one semester organic course,
mm-hmm.
Which Harold Snyder and I later became co-authors. There were lots of seniors in chemistry at Illinois, and the faculty there encouraged the seniors to work with Harold Snyder. Started off the same year I did. We went there as postdocs together and then started in the faculty, mm-hmm. the next year together. And the senior faculty were very helpful in pushing students, seniors, our way to get started, and later PhD students.
That's very helpful.
Wonderful group of men to work with. They were just great.
Mm-hmm.
Very different. Roger and Speed. Roger is an Eastern aristocrat. Speed, a farm boy from Central Illinois.
I think. From what I understand, he always tried to con people into thinking that he was always this backward farm boy.
was the image he liked to project. And then he'd beat the hell out of you at poker.
Great. How did you... the next year... For some reason, these little boxes in American Men of Science say that you were an instructor, then you were an associate, and then you became an assistant professor. What was the distinction
that
there?
That is an academic rank that they had at Illinois that I don't know that they had any other place.
Okay.
It was just one extra step up the ladder.
Oh, okay. How much were you making as an instructor? Did your salary change when you went to postdoc?
I might have jumped to $2,000,
okay.
Or maybe $2,400. I don't know. It's that order. It was either $2,000 or $2,400.
Okay. Okay. That gives me an idea of what people were making in those days. How do you decide on your first problems? You started to work on, these aren't papers you recommended to me, but I noticed the titles. You were doing alkylation of naphthalene and then some pyridate oxidation and some cis-trans isomerizations. Any particular reason why you opted to do any of those?
Well, the Friedel-Crafts stuff, of course, was developed some in my thesis. I had to make tertiary butyl naphthalene, and I got very much intrigued by some problems that hadn't been solved about the alkylation of naphthalene and Friedel-Crafts. Some people had reported pure compounds that were eutectic mixtures and things like this.
Yeah.
So we had to straighten a few of those things out. They weren't earth-shaking problems, but they were good things to get started on, good experience for senior students.
Mm-hmm.
You had to pick something that was fairly easy for a senior to do. The pyridate problem, I really don't remember how I got interested in that. Funny. Maybe I read it in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
In a very specific cleavage of glycols, and I thought it would be interesting to do the kinetics of it. It's an easy reaction to measure. It's fast, and just titrate the pyridate to iodate conversion. So it seemed like an easy one to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Had a senior do that work. I do remember how I got started in polymers.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you, sure. How did you do that?
Well, Speed Marvel came around. He made optically active secondary butyl acrylate, alpha chloroacrylate with a D secondary butyl on it, to see if he could make optically active polymer.
Yep.
And so he came around one day and he said, Charlie, if you want to study kinetics of reaction, why don't you study one that's worth, one that's useful, like polymerization. He says, I've got this optically active monomer, and he says, we found out that the polymer has a very different optical rotation than monomer. It ought to be pretty easy for you to study it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I jumped at the chance. He gave us some of the stuff to work with. In fact, he even gave me the student, Bob Kell.
Mm-hmm.
He pushed Kell. Kell, I think.
Here. That's what you want to do. It was Bob Kell.
I think it wanted to work for Speed, and Speed had a great big group, and he kind of pushed Bob my way and also suggested this problem. And it turned out to be a very good suggestion. I don't think Speed could have known this, but many peroxide catalyzed polymerizations have fairly complex kinetics, because you can have either the first order decomposition of peroxide is the initiation,
right,
or you can have a catalyzed decomposition,
right,
of the peroxide. That gives you a rather complex kinetic.
Right.
This was an absolutely perfect, simple kinetics. Half order peroxide, first order monomer, just fit absolutely beautifully with a first order initiation, then a second order radical monomer reaction, and then a second order radical termination. And so we were able to show that particular one fit those kinetics beautifully, and that was the mechanism. And that led me then immediately to see that the peroxide was not a catalyst, it was a chain initiator, and that led us right into proving that those were end groups present in the polymer. I think we were the first to show that the catalyst fragments were at the chain ends of the polymer.
Mm-hmm.
A simple logical conclusion from the mechanism, and actually Florey had proposed that mechanism about a year before,
mm-hmm,
from literature data.
But we
got much cleaner kinetics than I think the typical kinetics in the literature were.
At that particular time, had you started any consulting where that would have fit in?
No.
That was just a totally academic problem at that point.
I imagine Speed had gotten interested in polymers from his consulting. Now, I didn't start consulting for Hercules until 41.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to spend some time on the problems, but I also want to spend some time just getting general feeling about physical organic chemistry. You said just a few minutes ago, you know, it really hadn't crystallized in the late 30s. When do you think it did crystallize? When did you consider yourself part of a community of physical organic chemists? You were continually fighting that battle at Illinois, I suspect.
Well, certainly those were the formative years, the late 30s. It crystallized, I guess, after World War II, and
mm-hmm,
we had a lot of people at Bartlett and Weinstein and Bill Young kind of seemed to have put enough together. Nothing really could happen during the war. Everybody was concentrating on the war. So I think it was right after the war that we had the first organic.
That's right. That was 1946. I think you left
Illinois.
That's when you left Illinois, and that must have been your first act as chairman at Notre Dame to set up that conference.
I had proposed that we ought to have some kind of an organized effort in physical organic chemistry before that, some kind of a publishing effort like organic syntheses or organic reactions, that we ought to have a monograph published,
mm-hmm,
on physical organic chemistry. And
right,
I couldn't get much enthusiasm for that somehow or other. But Paul and I did decide that we could organize this mechanisms conference.
Paul said he just went along for the ride. It was your idea.
My idea. I'd kind of pushed this other idea that we ought to have a little thing that came out summarizing or physical organic. There was no way people could put their thoughts together.
You know, it took another 20 years before that happened. It wasn't until the early 1960s that there was advances in and progress in physical organic.
But that was my first idea, was to do that. And I just couldn't get... I talked to Paul and a couple of other people. I can't remember who. And I know Paul. And I just didn't get much enthusiastic response for it at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was too early. Maybe there wasn't a big enough field to do something like that. But Paul was quite willing to co-sponsor the Organic Mechanisms Conference. So we had that.
How did you go about deciding who was going to talk and who to invite? It's become a very elitist conference now, and I don't know if it was in those days or not.
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think I saved any of that stuff when I left Notre Dame. I'm sure I had a whole file on that conference, and I know I don't have it now.
Yeah, I've contacted some people out at Notre Dame, and Tony Trizzolo has everything over the last 15 or 20 years, and but he's given me names of people I've got to start contacting.
I suppose Paul and I made the decisions as to who to invite, but we invited all the leading people we could think of. I'm sure Saul Weinstein was there, Jack Roberts was there. I don't know whether guy at Harvard, Nobel Prize winning organic chemist. Isn't that awful? Bob Woodward. I don't know whether Woodward was there or not.
Yeah.
I think Taft was there. I can't really remember. Yeah. I just don't remember. I know
Taft may have been too young.
He might not have been.
That's right. I think he postdoced for Hammett about 4 or 5 years later, and so
he might not have been there.
Yeah, yeah. Hammett was there, and
Hammett would have certainly been there.
What about Hammett's book? What kind of impact do you think that had?
Tremendous. That was, I should have been, that wasn't what, that came along after. I was a graduate student, of course.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't published until 1940.
Oh, I think that was an extremely influential book.
Do you think that sort of crystallized?
Yes, it certainly helped a great deal to crystallize me. And, it was extremely influential for me.
Mm-hmm.
I
know you referred to
the basis of my Chem Reviews paper, in which I tried to calculate what some of these effects were, and it was very much a part of the QE scheme.
Mm-hmm.
My familiarity with the Hammett sigma rho and how it developed, what the theoretical basis. Hammett was always very funny about that. In my opinion, he's such a purist physical chemist that he didn't like to admit that there was any theoretical basis. He liked to call his equation empirical.
Yes. Yes.
And there's a hell of a good theoretical basis for it, the electrical interaction. Ehring used those electrical interactions as an additive factor in the activation energy. I don't know why Hammett was so skittish about.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very critical of me for thinking there was a theoretical basis. I just don't quite understand, because there was a good theoretical basis for it. But in any event, the fact that you could add an electrical factor to the activation energy led us to add a resonance factor to the activation energy, and that became the Q factor in the copolymerization equation.
Mm-hmm.
And not only became it, but became a way of measuring the resonance effect in reactions. I mean, you could get it gave you a quantitative number that measured the amount of resonance stabilization of factors of substituents attached to carbon-carbon double bonds. But an awful lot of the purists didn't like to interpret things. I always felt that's what good science is about. I mean, if you have just the cold numbers, you haven't really got the feel of what science is about.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
yeah. No, I think that's important. The contrasting approaches help me a good deal.
And incidentally, on the QE scheme, just since we're talking about it, Walling was always a detractor of this. Mm-hmm. And he told me the reason he was a detractor is that he thought of it first and thought it was no good because there was no absolute way to determine Q and E.
Yeah.
And that's right, there is none.
Mm-hmm.
You have to assign a monomer, a Q and an E, and you just have to be reasonable about it. And Hammett Sigma gave me a very good way of picking where I wanted the E to be.
Yeah.
You know, this plus and minus sigmas, if E is going to be quantitative related to it, which it is, they're linear related to E, that gives you a way of picking your scale for E, and then that helps you fix the Q values. But Walling was always very negative about that at the beginning, and I gather it's because he said he thought of it first and thought it wasn't any good. I don't know. That's what he told me.
That happens, somebody told me. At times.
And Chavis and I are good friends, but again, he
I would have talked to him this fall. I'll see if I can get his...
Yeah.
Okay, now, at some time in this period of 1938 to 1942, there's a sort of a shift occurring in organic chemistry, or up to 1946, there's a shift occurring. It's not an overthrow, it's not a revolution, I don't think, but physical organic chemistry is emerging.
It became recognized sometime in that decade. Yeah.
Can you, in any way, give me a general impression of what was happening? How did the classical organic chemists, were they fighting it tooth and nail, or did they recognize that some kind of change was about to occur and that it was inevitable, or can you think of anything that Speed Marvel might have said, or Roger Adams said or did?
I suppose the wartime research itself had an effect on this because everybody had to pitch in.
Yep.
Bartlett did a lot of work on nitrogen mustards. We did a lot of work on nitrogen mustard, sulfur mustard.
Right.
Saul Weinstein was always shocked at the end of the war to find out how much we developed in the way of Ank America that he didn't know about.
Yeah.
So funny. Honestly, God, it was just the funniest damn thing. Well, that's another story. But he just couldn't believe that we really had come up with all these ideas during the war. And that's an interesting story, Paul's and my development of the three-membered ring.
I'd like to hear that. In fact, there was one little paper. It seems almost an insignificant paper. You have, it was one you recommended to me. It was the analysis of the mustard using thiosulfate. And, it's a nice, clever little idea. But the important thing in it seemed to be the three-membered ring. And did you recommend it to me because that was the first time somebody had put that in print?
People before had been running as carbonium ions, which is just nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
There's still crazy characters that write nitrogen mustard. Not chemists, but the biologists that write nitrogen mustard is going through carbonium. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It's
amazing how something gets started that's wrong and how hard it is to get the right thing done. But what I was going to say is that Paul Bartlett had to work on practical problems. I had to work on practical problems, polymerization. I worked on the mechanism of emulsion polymerization during the war.
Well, that was an OSRD project, too. Or that was just...
I just did that kind of one guy on the side. I think maybe Speed smuggled me a little rubber research money to do that one thesis on emulsion polymerization of styrene. But we had to work on the behavior of chemical warfare agents in water, and it turned out to be very useful to know the mechanism of these reactions was, and it turned out to be very useful to know the mechanism of the reaction of SBR rubber, styrene butadiene rubber, the mechanism of the mercaptan modifier, the
control the molecular weight. It just fit in hand and glove with what I've been doing and what I've been saying about chain transfer mechanisms and so on. So mechanisms earned their keep in a lot of practical problems that people were forced to work on. Some of these people might not have worked on practical problems if it wasn't for the war. I'm not sure I wouldn't have, but maybe Paul Bartlett wouldn't have. He would have picked, you know, esoteric academic examples instead of working on practical things that everybody knew were important. And I think this got across to the more conventional chemists that this stuff wasn't purely esoteric, that it could perform a useful function. Mm-hmm. And I think it helped educate a lot of chemists, you know, like Roger Adams, who was head of the National Defense Research Committee, a chemistry section, and Speed, who was doing all this rubber research. They began to see that, these things weren't totally useless, even though a lot of people still do a lot of totally useless stuff, what I call crossword puzzle chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, which is an interesting solving the New York Times crossword puzzle is an interesting intellectual challenge, but when you've solved it, you haven't pushed the fate of humanity very far forward. And too much, I think, still happens that way, when you could pick something that would not only solve the problem but be useful.
Yes.
But in the war, we all had to do useful stuff, and we had to work together. You know, in peacetime, we're a bunch of damnedest independent, contrary characters you could imagine. But in the war, we had to work together and had to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And so guys like Adams and Marvel had to listen to guys like Bartlett and myself and Bill Young, who were working on problems they knew had to be solved. So I think the war played a very important accelerating role in getting that stuff recognized. I've never really thought about it this way before, but I think it
you know, it makes a lot of sense. It also must have had an enormous impact on industrial outfits, because after the war, they suddenly recognized and they started to look for physical organic chemists to do that. So, and they could see what.
So I think it helped greatly speed up the process of. Legitimizing.
That's a good idea.
The physical organic approach to problems. That wartime cooperation.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the problems you turned me on to.
We got a problem coming up. I'm going to have a date at 10:30 with Lonzi Liu.
Is this fellow coming in, or you have to?
He's going to come here.
Okay.
But I just want to be sure he knows I'm in.
All right.
Because I've been out so much. Let me just
come in. The review article of the aromatic substitution. What possessed you to write that at that particular point? Did you think it would be a good thing for you to do? Or is it somebody saying, "Hey, how about doing that?"
No, I don't think I had any real reason why I felt that I ought to do it for any reasons of that kind. I think it was just something that I thought was interesting to try to assess the effects on electrophilic substitution from electrostatic.
Okay,
because that was in there.
You did tend to ignore the resonance work, and the thing that was interesting, you ignored the English school almost entirely. There wasn't any reference to Ingold and Robertson. Was that intentional or?
No, I don't think so. It's probably just my own ignorance at the time. I wasn't as well aware of that as I should have been.
I see.
I've never been as much of a scholar as I should have been. You know, I don't like to read a lot of other stuff. I like to do what I like to do. And I do only the amount of reading that seems to be absolutely essential to me. And So I guess this has gotten me in trouble sometimes, and that you're absolutely right. I was low on my knowledge of those people, just as they were very low on their knowledge of what I was doing.
Yes.
When I went to talk to Ingold, I was flabbergasted. I had little to know about free radical reactions and the work we've been doing on free radicals. So, I mean, when you get immersed in your own thing, you just don't do as much. But I did have this idea, which I about the importance of simple electrical interactions, and I thought this was a good vehicle to express those views.
Yeah.
And I guess I was a little brash in giving less weight than I would now to resonance. I think I have a little more balanced view now. But it just struck me then when I did those calculations that you could estimate that the electrical interaction was enough to account for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still convinced that in ionic reactions, it is by far the most important contributor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quantitatively.
Yeah.
If there's a pole or a dipole interacting with a charge, that's going to be more important than the resonance interaction with that. But, now I just don't deny at all that there are, and certainly when we got involved in free radical reactions, the stabilization of the carbon free radical is not electrostatic.
Yeah.
Not entirely electrostatic. So my conclusion was that in the ionic reactions, resonance was a small factor. In free radical reactions, it's a fairly significant factor. Not the only one. The E values do affect the copolymerization very significantly. But so it was to express those views, I think, more than anything else that I wanted to get that Camry Youth article on it.
Okay. Good. So, work on 4-hydroxyquinolones with Royston Roberts. Was he a student of yours?
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, your PhD student.
What?
That was for the antimalarial program.
Yeah. Okay.
I had two major programs during the war under my own supervision. One was on antimalarial drugs, and one was on water treatment, water contaminated with chemical warfare agents. I collaborated with Speed a little bit on the rubber program, and I did a few others. I collaborated with Bob Husson on some of his work on chemical warfare agents, but my own program was was mainly the antimalarial drugs and the water treatment effect of chemicals.
So the mustard work was with
that was done under this water treatment program.
Oh. Okay.
We were involved in trying to determine the behavior of chemical warfare agents in water, to analyze for their presence in water, and to devise satisfactory methods of decontaminating water with chemical warfare. And that's where we did the work on the mechanism of hydrolysis of mustard.
Okay.
And that's why it came out the way it did.
I see. Yeah.
And I also did work with collaboration with Husson on the composition of the mustard gas that was made by the Levenstein process, and we discovered that by hydrolysis, we discovered that it was about 80% monosulfide and 20% pentatoheptasulfide. It didn't hydrolyze, that was unreactive to hydrolysis, so the water treatment work helped with that.